Good morning. Network, this is the news. On time, we're live in Accra, and you've tuned into the WGXC morning show. We have a full show for you with all sorts of songs and sounds and stories. In just a few minutes, Roger Hannigan Gilson from the Albany Times Union will be here live in the Hudson studio to talk about some recent stories, federal help for local farmers, and the sale or not of a local media outlet. We'll hear all about that in just a moment. We'll also hear about an art show from Ali Wist called Metabolizing Time at RPI's MPAC. Includes a communal feast and edible clay, geologically inspired food. So we'll hear all about that and more. We've got the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local better weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. It all starts after the local news, which is next. Stay tuned. You're listening to the WGXC Morning Show live from Hudson. This is the network, network, and the moon turns the blood. A stream runs through, and the moon turns the blood. This is the network, network, and the moon turns the blood. A stream runs through, and the moon turns the blood. This is the network, network, this is the moon turns the blood. This is the network, runs through, this is the moon turns the blood. This is the network.
This is Stuart Moxham of The Gist, and you are listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Hello, WGXC listeners. This is Matthew Vinny Harrington, Camp Hill, Hudson, Community Dinner Return. Come one, come all. Community Dinner is back at Camp Hill, Hudson, on Tuesday, September 5th at 5:30 p.m. in evening time at our Solaris building at 360 Warren Street, Hudson, New York. Come experience community meal, new people and old friends over a fresh prepared meal with lovely vegetables meal by local volunteers. We'd be glad to see you there, and please bring a friend.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Randall and Bernadette Martin of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tamro in Accra with the WGXC Daily News for Thursday, August 24th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Matthew Sprague and Justin Velasquez report at New York State of Politics that Governor Kathy Hochul signed an executive order August 23rd mandating state agencies buy more New York-sourced food. The order gradually increases the percentage of state-sourced food from New York farmers and producers from 5% now to 30% by the end of 2027. That would add almost $400 million in income to New York farmers. Hochul said, quote, by increasing the amount of food state agencies must buy from local growers and producers, we are further investing in farm production and food processing in New York. We will continue taking bold action to support our next generation of farmers and the future of agricultural industry for decades to come, unquote. New York Department of Agriculture Commissioner Richard Ball said, quote, "I want to see it grow. I mean, 30% is a starting point as far as I'm concerned," unquote. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. Paul Kirby reports in the Daily Freeman that New York's Public Service Commission will only hold 4 remote public hearings about Central Hudson Gas and Electric Corp's request to raise gas and electricity rates, but no in-person meetings. Assemblyperson Jonathan Jacobson of Newburgh has called for in-person hearings. Jacobson wrote to the commission that, quote, "While virtual events allow many attendees to participate from the comforts of their home, they exclude those who don't have computers and or reliable Wi-Fi service. This means that citizens who are economically challenged and arguably least able to afford a rate increase are excluded from making their voices heard," unquote. Central Hudson wants approval for a 16% hike in electricity rates and a 19% increase for gas. 2 virtual hearings will be on September 12th at 1 p.m. and 5 p.m. To join, visit a website and password information on the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org. There's passwords and addresses for each of the online public hearings on the WGXC newsroom. Raymond Pignone in Columbia Green Media reports that the New York State Public Service Commission will hold a public hearing on August 29th in Catskill about the already approved Champlain-Hudson Power Express project. The hearing is at 1 p.m. August 29th on the second floor of Catskill Town Hall, 439 Main Street. The 339-mile, 1,000-megawatt energy transmission line will pass through Coxsackie, Athens, New Baltimore, and Catskill in Greene County, moving energy from Quebec to New York City. Environmental advocacy group Riverkeeper opposes the project, saying it will impact aquatic life and navigation and threaten drinking water. Cables will be buried underwater and underground in the plant. Champlain-Hudson Power Express received an incentive package from the Greene County Industrial Development Agency. The public hearing is about a proposed amendment to the plan, changing a segment about 1 mile that has been approved by the Catskill Town Board and the Catskill Village Board of Trustees. The change would shift the transmission line away from some homes onto New York State Department of Transportation land along Route 23 and Route 9W. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Benny Willis will go down in American history for having conducted one of the worst attacks on the American Constitution.
Rudy Giuliani was one of 3 key election lawyers for former President Donald Trump who surrendered Wednesday at the Fulton County Jail over charges tied to their attempts to assist Trump to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Giuliani is charged with 13 crimes and called the indictment a travesty. Lawyer Sidney Powell faces 7 state charges and Jenna Ellis faces 2. Meanwhile, requests by former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and ex-Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark to extend the deadline to turn themselves in were denied by the judge, who said 2 weeks was ample time. Trump is expected to turn himself in today. Several Republican presidential hopefuls took to the stage Wednesday for their first debate in Milwaukee. Republican Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene rejected them all to support former President Donald Trump.
I was surprised that I didn't know who the governor of North Dakota and some other people were. They really don't have a chance because America knows what we had 4 years with President Trump.
Trump opted not to participate in the debate, but sat down with former Fox News host Tucker Carlson for a pre-taped interview on X, the platform formerly called Twitter. Trump is averaging more than 50% support in national polls. Polling indicates Trump and President Biden are likely to be locked in a tight contest in a 2024 rematch. Leaders of the Democratic National Committee, as well as Biden-Harris campaign officials, spoke hours before the GOP debate. The committee's Jamie Harrison called every candidate who took to the debate stage extreme with radical positions.
This group is as extreme as it gets. A bag full of MAGA apples, and they are all rotten. They are wildly out of step with the American people.
The Republican National Committee released a video Wednesday promoting early voting and mail-in voting, a complete flip-flop from the last presidential election cycle when the party repeatedly attacked the voting practices. Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel came out in favor at the end of last year and encouraged members to embrace the move.
When Republicans vote early, we win.
Protest signs were back at the Tennessee State House Wednesday after a judge temporarily blocked a new rule advanced by House Republicans, banning them during floor and committee hearings. The ruling followed a lawsuit filed after state troopers removed three women Tuesday who held signs calling for gun control to protect children.
We have rights to hold a sign. This is not what democracy looks like.
The Tennessee legislature is currently holding a special session to address guns and mental health. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our ATRA syndicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. June 25th was the 10th anniversary of Shelby County versus Holder, a U.S. Supreme Court decision gutting a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. What was this decision about, and how has it contributed to the erosion of our democracy? Decades of systemic racist voter suppression and violence spurred passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, outlawing discrimination in voting on the basis of race and enforcing the 15th Amendment. Section 5 of the VRA created pre-clearance requirements for states, counties, or municipalities with a history of voter discrimination. It required them to clear any new election rules with the U.S. Justice Department. But in 2012, Shelby County, Alabama, argued to the U.S. Supreme Court that Section 5 was unconstitutional. Instead, the court ruled that the formula used to apply preclearance was outdated and asked Congress for an update. Congress has enacted, so Section 5 has been unenforceable since 2013. The decision greenlighted a resurgence of voter suppression bills in conservative-leaning states with large black or Hispanic populations. Among the shady tactics are reductions in polling places, shortening of early voting, attempting to stop voter registration drives, narrowing voter ID options, and even preventing the handing out of food and water to voters forced to wait in long lines, all making it harder for our fellow Americans to vote. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Thursday, August 24th. Local early morning temperatures range from 50 degrees in Steventown to 62 in Skodak. Regional average soil temperature is 69 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be medium high, but don't expect it to stay there. Today will be cloudy and starts out dry. Around 10 a.m., some of us will see a few raindrops. By 3 p.m., half of us should see falling rain. We get a high of 69 at 4 p.m. Overnight, rain continues, picking up after midnight. We see a low of 63. Tomorrow is expected to have a more rainy morning, with some bangs of thunder rolling through in the afternoon. We see a high of 76 at 4 p.m. Overnight, rain stops and we get a low temperature of 65 degrees. Saturday, we'll have a rainy afternoon and a high of 79. Sunday will be dry with a high of 75. Today's tide schedule is low tide at 3:22 a.m., high tide at 8:39 a.m., low tide again at 2:52 p.m., then high tide once again at 9:15 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 73 degrees and the tide strength is low. Sunset today will be at 7:31 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:09 a.m. Looking way up, we see plasma winds will be average at 410 kilometers per second with a thin density of 1 proton per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently far below 8 megahertz, then far below 60 overnight. There are no chances of aurora tonight. The current sunspot number is 99, and this has been the better weather. Brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
All right, you have tuned into the WGXC Morning Show, and I'm Tom Rowe, your host for this hour. And joining us right now in the studio is Roger Hennigan Gilson, making his weekly appearance. He is the reporter for the Times Union, one of the reporters for the Times Union that covers the Hudson Valley. Several cover the Hudson Valley, but you are seem like the most prominent.
I'm the Columbia Green guy.
So I guess I notice your stories more often because they're right around the corner usually.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it varies, but there's the Hudson Valley crew and kind of the Central Times Union crew, and I'm in between the two.
And what have you been working on this week?
Well, this week, the two big stories that I was working on was the declaration that all upstate counties, could receive funding after the crop losses last May.
The late freeze.
It was a very late freeze. It happened, it was like May 16th, I believe. The growing season in New York starts May 1st, and that means essentially, like, there is no possibility of it going below 32. So, like, 3 weeks after that, it's, like, very unusual.
And a lot of damage. The grapes are all, not all ruined, but many ruined. Apples,
many,
problems.
Many ruined. Yeah, no, the two most heavily impacted crops were grapes and apples. And, you know, they're also two of the, highest produced and traded produce around here. You know, New York apples, they're delicious. The apples and the grapes were heavily damaged. Essentially, to get an emergency declaration from the federal government, you have to prove that 30% of the crop in a particular county is just gone. And, you know, the majority of upstate counties, like, were able to do that. But with the way it's set up is that any counties adjacent to the counties that had the emergency declaration are also eligible. So it's literally, like, every county north of the Bronx.
So what does that mean for actual local farmers who had crops damaged in the freeze in May?
Well, it means that they are eligible for these very low interest loans from the federal government through the USDA. They still have to go through an application process. It's just not automatic or anything. The loans can pay up to 100% of, like, both or either the money amount of, the crops that were damaged or the, costs for producing them in the first place.
So farmers getting a little help, but
It could be a lot.
It's been a kind of a. It's a tough summer overall. I would think it was kind of dry early, and then it's been kind of wet lately. I saw a story in the Berkshire paper about how hay farmers are having a hard time with the second mow because it's just so wet.
Yeah, that's a big problem. I mean, it just seems the last like 5 years it has either been really, really wet or really, really dry. During the summer. A friend of mine who is a farmer is just like, he's been rather stressed out the last few growing seasons. He has to irrigate everything when it's too dry and then it's too wet, and that's an issue also.
So it's just tough being a farmer because you can't totally accurately predict these things. I don't know. I guess the Times Union has a big story today that you didn't do, but someone else did, that says that because of El Nino, it may be a warm, wet winter.
Yeah, that is a possibility. Honestly, I did not read that story.
Yeah, no, it,
I
guess
we produce a lot of stories. I can't read them.
I just saw it, and it's basically 2015 or so. There was last time there was an El Nino like this, and we had a warm, wet winter, and so they're saying could happen again.
Yeah, El Nino is so odd. It's just like really a change in ocean currents in the Pacific Ocean, but, you know, the globe and everything, it is so interconnected that it has effects, like, across the globe.
Yeah, we're probably only beginning to understand.
Yeah, it's complicated.
What other stories were you working on this week besides the farmers getting a little help?
The Register Star, a.k.a. Hudson Valley 360, which includes the Daily Mail, announced in March in their paper that they were being purchased by the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. We also, obtained an internal memo from them that, said essentially the same thing. It was also put out in March. And, you know, there was hopes that it could happen then, but it still has not happened. There's been delay after delay.
And the problem is some weird something about liens or something, which I don't understand.
Well, you know, we were unable to get the precise reason why it was not going through. But
because the Register Star folks didn't talk to you, right?
They did a bit. I mean, they're owned by Johnson Newspaper Corporation, which is way upstate. And they own papers also in northern New York. Both the publisher and the managing editor were on vacation last week, so it was hard to...
It's August, so...
Yeah, it's vacation month. It's vacation month. You know, we emailed them back and forth a bit. But yeah, there's just been repeated holdups. The Daily Gazette was telling me that, you know, they still would love to make the purchase. They were going forward and hoped it happened soon, but the Register Star kind of had to get their financial ducks in a row first to hand over a clean title to, you know, Hudson Valley 360.
And I guess the idea is that there'd be some synergy there. They could sell some advertising over the whole capital region since the two papers would cover, you know, not Albany particular, but sort of surrounding Albany.
Yeah, kind of a ring around part of Albany. But, yeah, no, the Daily Gazette is, you know, they'll be kind of extending their influence down to the Twin Counties. Daily Gazette said, like, they really hoped for the Daily Mail and the Register Star to actually have more content. The fear is always that, like, you know, there's going to be consolidation and that kind of thing. Part of the additional comment is going to be common pages, like a state section, a national, section that runs in the Daily Gazette and also a couple other of their papers. And, you know, if the purchase goes through, Daily Mail and Register Star will have those. But they're also saying that they hope to have additional unique content, too. You know, they might very well hire more reporters instead of firing anyone.
And this isn't the typical... national chains come in and buy local newspapers, and it's often for the real estate. And I don't think the Daily Mail or Register Star owns buildings here, right?
No, they rent.
Yeah, so it's not the same kind of national chain coming in, selling off the parts... to make money situation that we've seen over and over again in other places.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's not like a scalping kind of thing. You know, I mean, Daily Gazette isn't like a huge national thing. They just had like a real interest in covering kind of this area. And it's not going to be like, you know, a large newspaper group just like coming in and stripping the paper bare. So, you know, that's a very good thing.
So we don't know what if the sale's going to go through or if it'll be a good thing, but we'll see, right?
We'll see. You know, the Daily Gazette believes that the sale could go through in September, though.
So I guess we'll keep monitoring the situation.
We will monitor it, yes.
And then I guess what could be a little, some people probably think is good news, is there's a new business or a business back?
Yes, Madison Theater, which is just in Greenport. Off Fairview Avenue. They reopened officially last Friday and started showing movies. And there's like improvements. Now, you know, they have more of an extended menu and they're developing this app that allows you, like, while you're watching the movie, to be like, oh, I want a hot dog. And then a hot dog gets delivered to you right there.
And this is the old Fairpoint 3. What was it called before? It was called. It was an old three movie theater chain that got bought by the Madison Theater in Albany, right, a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
That's why it is called Madison Theater now? Or is it owned by the same people, or is it different management or something?
There's, like, different management between the Albany one and the Hudson one, but, yeah, it's
and it
the
closed,
same.
Like, during COVID, or was it before?
Really, towards the tail end of it. It was September 2022.
And they reopened with the food because
yeah.
they didn't have the food in the old when it was the Fairport free screens. I mean, right,
such,
but not in the seats the way.
Yeah, no, not
they
redid
the seats. It's more the comfortable
draft house kind of style.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it seems like a great concept because you don't want to miss 5 minutes of the movie because then you're just all confused and don't get the plot. Yeah, and also they've gotten their liquor license, you know, which is like a really arduous process even for like restaurants and bars. I imagine it was a bit harder with a movie theater. But they still have to set up the taps and stuff, but they're going to have draft beer, and they can deliver that to your seat, too.
And there's no other theater I can think of around here that has alcohol.
I mean, it's like a thing. Like, certain theaters are doing it, but no, none anywhere around here. Yeah, so they're first in on that.
If that's what you're saying, then it's open there over on... in Greenport.
Yeah, yeah. Fairview and, you know, Popeye. They open every day at 3. And also, $1 tickets for seniors on Sunday. That's a steal. And then on Tuesdays, anyone can get cheaper tickets, too.
And I think I saw this Sunday is national, some sort of national movie day. A lot of the theaters are doing $4 theaters. I saw a $4 admission and the definitely the Highway Drive-In Highway Drive-In in Coxsackie yeah. is doing $4 on Sunday. So
that's an excellent price. I didn't know about that, but yeah, go out to the...
I don't know what if the other movie theaters are doing it, but it's a national thing they're trying to do. But it's been a busy movie summer, I guess.
Yeah, now people are going back to the movies, you know, which is great. You know, people should do things not in their homes. I just saw the Barbie movie last weekend. Like, the hype... you know, is real. It deserves the hype. It's an excellent movie.
I will say the Oppenheimer movie also does deserve the hype, and it was very good.
Yeah, they're like the two big movies at the moment, and they're just polar opposites in every way. It's funny.
On the nail, when I saw Oppenheimer the other night, there were parents dropping their female daughters at Barbie and their male daughters at Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh.
So there's also that we, it's not, the media hasn't caught on to the Barbie Turtles.
I haven't caught on to the Ninja Turtles. They have a movie now?
I think it's second or third one, but yeah.
I remember the original. It came out when I was a young child, like 30 years ago, and it was amazing. Really good live action. It was just guys, actors in like turtle suits. It totally worked, though.
Well, you can go have a drink and watch it now, probably.
Yeah, yeah. You know, just add to the surreality of the experience by having a giant beer in your hand.
All right. We've been speaking to Roger Hannigan-Gilson from the Times Union, who covers Columbia and Greene counties and is here weekly to update us on what's going on. Thank you for telling us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, talk to you guys next week.
All right, next we're going to hear about Ali Wiest, an artist that has a show up at RPI and MPAC. Hold on, here it is.
Creating a large-scale installation can feel like a very daunting task. MPAC gives the possibility of using some of their facilities to their graduate students. And I'm going to reflect with Ali Wiest on the recent exhibition, Metabolizing Time. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you so much for having me, Sina.
Can you introduce your program and the process of bringing Metabolizing Time to MPAC?
Yeah, sure. So I'm in the Interdisciplinary Arts PhD program, and as a part of that program, we are invited to apply for a residency slot at MPAC, where we actually get to interact with the staff, get support from the staff to make some kind of installation in one of their spaces. Some students actually use it as an opportunity to film or create some sort of media related to their work. But I took on the task of creating a 360 film installation. And it actually did have a sensory installation component in addition to a panoramic film environment, which was something I had never even attempted before. But with the help of MPAC, actually pulled it off.
That's interesting because I've seen your work before. You had an installation at Collarworks, and I do think of your work as sensory. So what are you referring to by sensory?
So in this instance, I did a kind of, I think I called it a sensory tableau, but it was sort of a dining experience table that was situated on the floor amidst a kind of faux heap of gravel. And all of the foods that were on the table were related to geology and bituminous tar and even fossil fuels and other sorts of consumable minerals that complicate actually even the notion of edibility. And so it was kind of a fun exploration of coal bread and tar candies and all kinds of weird stuff.
You were also exploring toxicity and how, do you think a lot of our foods are toxic, or was it just more of a play of like challenging our concept of food? Was that a part of it?
Sure, yeah. I was interested kind of conceptually in the notions of metabolism, both of our bodies and then also of landscapes. So the only mineral kind of rock that we consume regularly is salt, but there have been historic precedent for people consuming clay and also, like I mentioned, bituminous tar, sort of in a more medicinal capacity. But we often consume the clay or tar for its detoxifying properties. And then I sort of honed in on this irony that while we are consuming earth materials to detoxify our bodies, we are putting inputs back into the earth that are toxifying soil. So whether that's the asphalt that contains tar that becomes waste, whether that's pollutants or heavy metals like lead in Troy especially, but our inputs back into clay and earth then that are toxic, and it's kind of a strange mutual metabolism. And it's especially one that plays out across deep time when you think about the landscape of Troy and what sort of strata and stratigraphy we create with all of the inputs we put back through industrial processes, agriculture, etc.
I'm kind of hung up on bituminous tar. I've heard of like, I've heard of eating charcoal, but tar, not so much. Yeah. Could you give us a little bit of a better understanding of, so people actually consume this, and how is it, like, what does that look like?
Yeah, so coal, a lot of people are familiar with the activated charcoal for detoxifying. It's a little bit misleading how it's presented sometimes, because it doesn't actually pull toxins out of your body that are there. It simply would kind of neutralize a toxin that your body was currently ingesting or digesting. And bituminous tar has been used medicinally in many cultures. It's called a lot of different things, so it's hard to research. It's also called mumia, and there was a kind of semantic slip between mummy and then the word mumia, which was used to reference a tar-like substance that could be extracted naturally. And people in Europe were so crazed for the medicinal kind of black tar that whenever there was sort of this semantic confusion, they started importing mummies from ancient Egypt and thought that the resinous kind of tar in the mummified bodies was the same thing, and were consuming that, which is somewhat horrifying. But the other kind of bituminous tar, especially in Persian medicine, is you can consume small bits of it just sort of daily or mixed into a beverage. My collaborator, Oliver Holochek, who owns Primo Botanica in Troy, used some of the tar called Shalajit in a caramel candy for the exhibition. So, you know, there have been a lot of different, I hate to point to one particular use of it, because depending what, if it's Islamic medicine or Chinese medicine, it's sort of been suggested for a variety of medicinal uses. As an aphrodisiac, of course, at one point.
You've all this wonderful research and ways of interacting with your art. What was the process like of bringing these ideas to this room, this black box room that included a 360 film screen?
Yeah, it was, I had a meeting with the folks at MPAC to kind of give a lay of the land for this interest in landscape metabolism and sort of speculative human-made geology, like asphalt and concrete, and then also considering edible geology. And they really helped me conceive of how you would put this into a atmospheric film. So I had some footage, but of course that would be from an SLR camera and you would have to really replicate it or collage it to get it to fill an entire room. And so they generously let me borrow a professional 360 camera. It's the Insta360, which sounds like it's made for Instagram, but their professional, I think it's the Pro 2 camera, is an incredibly advanced camera. It has 6 different fisheye lenses on it, which are then stitched together to make a panoramic film. And even just 5 minutes of video results in like 6 gigabyte video files. So they really helped me conceive of how I could turn various landscapes and wastescapes or industrial scapes in Troy into an environment for that space.
I want to try to describe the room for listeners. First, you enter the amazing MPAC building, and then coming into this side room, the visitor's dwarfed by the 360 screen. And in the middle, there was light on the table that had your homemade asphalt and the food that you could eat. And there was music playing. Mm-hmm. What else am I missing?
Well, it was, yeah, it sort of oscillated between the table becoming a kind of altar that was lit with yellow light for a while, and then that would dim and the film would play. And it was really interesting because one of the really helpful coordinators and curators at MPAC, Sam, had helped me to calculate using this camera how you would make a human to scale in that 360 film so that they felt the exact same as a body in that space. And then I had to sort of reevaluate because I didn't actually want it to be at scale. I wanted the human in the footage to be just wildly oversized. And so as the lights dim and the film plays, there is some short text, and then it oscillates between these large industrial heaps of gravel and kind of some of the waste and detritus along the river over in North Troy. And then scenes of me climbing the gravel heaps where my legs are, I think my leg was 9 or 10 feet tall. And then another scene of me eating some of the coal-based foods, and my mouth is also something in the realm of 5 feet tall. So it sort of gave this really intense impression of a body's presence, or at least that's what I was hoping.
So this exhibition is finished, so listeners cannot come to see it, but where are other opportunities to engage with you and your work?
Oh, well, on Instagram is probably the place that I post a lot of it, and I'm at AESWIST, which is WIST, or if you just search for AlleyWIST, you can usually find me and what's happening in and around Troy often.
To close out, what would you like to leave our listeners with? What would you like them to take away from your work and maybe future goals?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think one thing I want people to take away is just what they take for granted. And my interest in asphalt is that it's ubiquitous, it's everywhere, and we don't ever think about it. And to actually consider what these materials might be in the far future in terms of archaeological findings or strata in the Earth's crust, and just what they represent, aggregates kind of systems of capitalism, of our civilization, of colonialism often. But just to think about those materials that we often really overlook in our daily life.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And here it's time now on WGXC to update you with what's going on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org. Go there and you can click on the add an event button. And if you're helping put on some local event, you can cut and paste the information in the boxes. And soon enough, someone like me will be reading about your event on the radio at 90.7 and seeing it around the world in the WGXC community calendar at wgxc.org. Thursday, August 24th, there is Movement and Music Storytime led by Abby Lappin at the Hudson Area Library at 4 p.m. The Hudson Thursday Market is at the Public Square in Hudson from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday. Thursday night in Catskill, the Avalon Lounge in Catskill is hosting Wesley Harper from Catskill, Daniel Kleederman, and the band Thank You, Thank You. They all perform from 8 to 11 in Catskill at the Avalon Lounge. WGXC should have a live web stream of the whole show at wgxc.org/listen. And the 8 to 9 p.m. hour should be on 90.7 FM, too. So turn out or tune in to the Avalon Lounge in Catskill Thursday, August 24th, for Wesley Harper, Daniel Kleederman, and Thank You, Thank You. Friday, August 25th, there's a House Blend concert. It's the third one at PS21 in Chatham with Adam Tendler on piano and Ayono Katarogo on percussion. That's from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at PS21 in Chatham on Friday night. Saturday in Catskill at the United Methodist Church, the weekly ukulele jam happens from 1:30 to 3 p.m. In Great Barrington Saturday at Ski Butternut, the Pink Floyd cover band The Machine are doing The Wall in its entirety at Ski Butternut in Great Barrington, 4:30 p.m. to 10. There's a nature community masquerade at the Kingston Point Rotary Park Saturday, August 26th at 5 p.m. William Tyler and the Impossible Truth and Garcia Peoples perform at Tubby's in Kingston Saturday, August 26th. That's at 8 p.m. Sunday, August 27th is the traditional Irish music session. Every week at the Shamrock House, you can bring out your instruments and jam with other locals from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Shamrock House in East Durham. Then on Monday, August 28th, Columbia County is honoring a vet. Veterans Committee will honor Tech Sergeant Jack Hallenbach. The public is invited at the ceremony 9 a.m. at the Columbia County Office Building, 401 State Street in Hudson. These events and many more are on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Luke Parsnow reports for New York State of Politics that while Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is in the Hudson Valley August 23rd to raise money for Representative Mark Molinaro's re-election campaign, Democrat Representative Pat Ryan has an invitation for him. Although one could say his offer to tour damage caused by last month's flood with McCarthy is more of a troll. Ryan said, and I quote, "I've spoken with disabled veterans whose homes are still in shambles, families previously in low-income housing that now have nowhere to live, and kids stuck in condemned homes because they can't afford repairs. I'm demanding that Speaker McCarthy look them in the eye and reassure them that his FEMA funding legislation will include individual assistance for Hudson Valley flood victims. The major disaster declaration was a critical first step to enable our recovery. But now Congress must come together to deliver relief for everyone impacted. I'll keep fighting, and I hope the Speaker will join me in doing what is right," end quote. Ryan represents New York's 18th Congressional District, while Molinaro represents the 19th District. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. Paul Kirby reports for the Daily Freeman that Representative Pat Ryan has so far failed in convincing the Social Security Administration to reopen an office in Ulster County. Ryan said, and I quote, "I won't give up fighting for Ulster County seniors. The closure of this Social Security office placed a tremendous burden on thousands of hardworking New Yorkers who earned this critical benefit. I'll keep pushing aggressively until we get this fixed," end quote. The Social Security Administration closed its Grant Avenue office in the Lake Katrine hamlet of the town of Ulster in March 2014 and a satellite office in the town of Ulster left in 2018. Senator Charles Schumer in 2014 also demanded the Social Security office remain open to no avail. Ryan is currently complaining that the office closure in 2018 means, and I quote, "Thousands have to travel upwards an hour to the nearest office in Poughkeepsie," end quote. But so far, Ryan's campaign to reopen an office has been as successful as Schumer's. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. Amelia Teasdale reports in the Upstater that the village of Kinderhook held a dedication ceremony July 29th for the newly named Dunham Park. Village Mayor Michael Abrams said that, and I quote, "The village park at the western corner of Broad and Hudson Streets will be named Dunham Park in honor of James C. Dunham and the Dunham family, in recognition of the many ways Dunham family members have benefited Kinderhook through their legacy of public service and sacrifice," end quote. James Jim Dunham served on numerous village boards and committees, including multiple terms as mayor and village trustee. Dunham did not run for re-election as mayor in 2020. Instead, he's getting the pocket park next to the bandstand and village square, where a statue of the former Kinderhook resident and U.S. President Martin Van Buren is seated on a bench named after him. The motion passed by the village board on July 12th to rename the park also honors his wife, Bonnie Becker Dunham, for her work, and I quote, "As a long-serving, dedicated, and skilled educator, Bonnie impacted the lives of many young people and parents. She also assumed lead volunteer positions as local organizer, including the Columbia County Historical Society and the Kinderhook Reformed Church," end quote. Read more about this story in the Upstater. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow. And now, here is your WGXC weather update. Here's your forecast for the next 2 days. Well, on Thursday, showers are likely mainly after 5 p.m. It will be cloudy with a temperature high near 67 degrees. On Thursday night, showers and possibly a thunderstorm with a temperature low of around 61 degrees. And on Friday, showers are likely and possibly a thunderstorm before 8 a.m. Then a chance of showers and thunderstorms between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. Then a chance of showers after 5 p.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature high near 73 degrees. And Friday night, a slight chance of showers before 8 p.m., then a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms between 8 p.m. and 11 p.m., then a slight chance of showers after 11 p.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature low of around 63 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC, 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, in Greene and Columbia Counties.
We're talking with Connor Webb, who is the president of the Gilderland chapter of March for Our Lives. This is, I think, primarily a student group that's been working on the issue of gun violence. So, Connor, can you give us an introduction to, you know, what is March for Our Lives and why did you help start this in Gilderland?
So, well, first, thank you so much for having me on, Mark. Our group, at its core, is an energetic team of young people changing gun laws here in the Capital Region and across this country. So we're a chapter of March for Our Lives that was founded a few years ago. It was born out of a tragic school shooting in Parkland, Florida. Some of the survivors of that shooting were galvanized into action. They organized that following month the largest single day protest of gun violence in human history. And since then, I founded the chapter in 2021. I was just fed up as people were going back to school with the abhorrent rates of school community gun violence. It's atrocious. And so since then, after founding the chapter, you know, we have a great team of advocates, really, who are pushing for sensible solutions to this terrible scourge of gun violence that we've seen in recent years.
So one of the things I've noticed from some of your social media postings, it does seem like the NYSA, the teachers union statewide, has been supportive, you know, of your group. What have been some of the highlights of your work so far?
Well, I can talk a little bit about that more. You know, obviously the New York State United Teachers is an incredible union, and we were really lucky to work with them last year in organizing a march in Albany So that was in June. It was in the wake of the shooting in Uvalde, where about 20 kids and teachers were gunned down by a teenager in Texas. So we wanted to raise some attention. There were a couple hundred sister marches across the country with March for Our Lives, and we were one of them. It was great to see Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado there. Once the reprehensible Supreme Court decision in Bruin came out, they called a special session of the legislature, and part of that was out of the concern that we really demonstrated in Albany that we need to protect our communities. But alongside, that march last year, we've written policy for our school district, actually, to make sure that we require parents of the school district to be notified of their responsibilities in securely storing their firearms if they have firearms in the household. We know that that's, guns that are unlocked and loaded are very dangerous in the presence of a child in the home. It's New York state law. And so we just pushed for, a piece of school policy that said, listen, let's tell our parents that that is state law and they need to comply with it. So it's those measures of education that we really advocated for, along with the other, I would describe them as notorious gun safety, pieces of legislation that we've seen nationally that we support as well. We've had 10 meetings with legislators in Albany this year, state senators and state assembly members, to push for our comprehensive list of gun bills that we find essential that they pass. Following that, we were with Moms Demand Action, Students Demand Action for gun safety, with that those lobbying sessions. And since then, when the state legislature ended, all three of the gun safety bills that we endorsed passed. So they're now on Governor Hochul's desk. So listen, despite the monopoly that groups like the National Rifle Association have over this conversation, and despite the really reprehensible Supreme Court ruling in Bruin, which I've mentioned already, that has really stifled the progress that we've tried so hard to make here, we are still making progress. So I am optimistic about this issue's future, even though it seems it's in a really dire place right now.
Now, of course, gun control, is a controversial issue within our society. People have different interpretations of the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution. New York State, probably one of the more liberal or states willing to consider gun control issues. But are there, on your wish list for the New York State Legislature, are there still things that you would like to see them enact?
Yeah, one of the things you're bringing up, too, is this idea that a lot of gun lobby groups, I've already mentioned the National Rifle Association, but gun manufacturers, too, they see the Second Amendment as a conversation stopper. And listen, I don't see any conflict in the Second Amendment that indicates that we can't, that the laws that we're pushing for are somehow unconstitutional. I don't think that the Founding Fathers anticipated that mentally ill teenagers could walk into their school and have access to an AR-15 and shoot up their school later. I just don't think that's, and the constitutional scholarship for 200 years was very clear on that point, until frankly in the past few decades when the National Rifle Association was able to control that conversation. But besides that, even then, even with the difficulties that we've seen really in the Supreme Court not being an ally to protecting our communities, our main push is to make sure that victims of gun violence are compensated for, that, we can use Medicaid reimbursement funds to support community violence intervention programs like SNUG in Albany and Troy, which have been very effective. And to make sure that we're doing that in a way that promotes a culture of responsible gun ownership, which is our big push, especially recently.
I am an attorney, and I always point out when I was a student in law school 50 years ago, if you had asserted in a constitutional law class that the Second Amendment gave the individual a personal right to own a gun, you would have failed the constitutional law class. So it is kind of striking, how radically our understanding of the Second Amendment have changed under sort of the present Supreme Court. But, how do students feel about this at this point? Are they, do they feel secure within their schools at this point? And, you know, what are some of the personal messages that, you know, your group tries to deliver people about how to increase safety for students?
Well, I'll answer this in two parts. First, I think you're making a very good point, Mark, which is that one thing to keep in mind, too, like when law review articles were first indexed, I think that was in the 1870s. There was no mention of that modern day NRA Supreme Court interpretation of the Second Amendment. That wasn't even indexed into, like, that wasn't even mentioned in any law review article until really like the latter half of the 20th century. So you're absolutely right there. But when it comes to students in schools, listen, the reason why I got involved in this work was because I was so disturbed with having to, you know, walk into my place of worship or to in a grocery store or schools and to have to worry about the idea that we won't make it out. You know, I was in a conversation a few years ago with a legislator and a few other members of organizations that serve youth. And the general idea that was, you know, the general idea that was yielded from that conversation was young people are in so much fear. And it's deeply unfortunate. And I, you know, I don't want our generation to be known as the lockdown generation. I don't want to have to go to my school and have to, you know, a place that really should be a place of comfort, a place of security. And when in a lot of schools across this country, including ours, that isn't, you know, our country isn't living up to that standard. And so that's why it's so crucial that we are holding our legislators accountable here, even in, and especially in the state of New York, when we do have very strong gun laws, but we have so much work to do in making sure that those gun laws are compensating victims and, you know, that we're pursuing a course of common and fair justice here.
So we only have about a minute left. So sort of closing, you know, statements. If people want to find out more about March for Our Lives, possibly sort of chapter at their own college, how best can they get background information at this point?
So feel free to reach out to us. You can go to marchforourlives.com and reach out to our chapter in specific. You can also follow our chapter on Instagram. You can follow March for Our Lives on Instagram at March for Our Lives. Twitter is the same for them. Our chapter specifically has an Instagram. It's at MFOL Gilderland. So all of those resources are great if you want to get involved.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Connor Webb, March for Our Lives, Gilderland High School. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
You and me, we're see-through, homesick and heartbroken. Would you turn me away if the walls were all I could see? In your place, leave me alone with my headphones. I'll be alright. I'll leave you alone with your headphones. We'll be just fine.
Your face.